Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Americans are getting older, and while nursing homes are closing for lack of staff, and our seniors are being denied the care they deserve, there's another path open to us. Immigrants want to help. Let them do it legally.
David Byers with the Cato Institute testifying last month before a Homeland Security Subcommittee on Border Security.
We know we need workers, from engineers to open the next generation of chip manufacturing in Arizona to seafood processors in Louisiana. But if our policies tell people that the only way to enter is to enter illegally, that's what's going to happen. But that's a policy choice. We choose the costs associated with illegal immigration every day. We don't reform legal immigration.
This is Agriculture Today.
My name is J.R. Ramirez. I live in La Pryor, Texas, where I manage two commercial cow-calf operations, each with extensive wildlife management programs.
He testified last month in front of a Homeland Security Subcommittee on Border Security.
Illegal immigration and lack of border security have changed ranching as we know it. Damaged fences and gates, high-speed chases, break-ins, stolen vehicles, and trespassing are daily occurrences. Ranchers like me on the front lines are bearing financial burdens that are threatening our ability to operate profitable businesses. In the last 12 months, our ranch has had 30 documented cases of our fences or gates being breached by a vehicle. The least damaging of those cases cost our operation $1,000, while other incidents have surpassed $10,000 in damages. A cut fence or open gate allows cattle to escape into other pastures or neighboring ranches. When that happens, additional hours of work are put in by our entire team to gather livestock, often requiring a helicopter to rectify the situation, a direct out-of-pocket cost to our ranch. These unexpected occurrences mean we may not be able to market cattle at the appropriate time or ensure that cattle breeding occurs at the right time. Our herd health can be at risk if neighboring cattle introduce disease that would otherwise not exist on our ranch. My stocking rate for livestock is limited when cattle graze sections of land that need rest as a result of cut fencing. These all take a direct hit to my potential profits on the operation. Plastic bottles, jugs, cans, backpacks, clothing, shoes, coats, and trash litter our property. I cannot clearly describe the amount of trash that now covers South Texas ranches. These materials will take hundreds of years to decompose and has led to cattle loss, as some items can be consumed and cause digestive failure in cattle. This is a long-term defacement of beautiful South Texas rangelands that will never be the same. Ranchers shoulder the burden of this financial loss. It doesn't stop there. Responsible and well-managed hunting leases are another way ranchers offset the formidable cost of ranching while also contributing to wildlife conservation within the state. High-dollar wildlife escape ranches when fences and gates are compromised. The danger along the border is so great, hunters and even landowners themselves may deem the risk on a property too high, forcing hunters to look elsewhere to hunt. When those sources of revenue are taken away, the chances of a profitable year greatly diminish. Finding employees is becoming more difficult as well because most do not want to live where their safety is at risk. Many employees who live on the ranch have their homes broken into frequently and never know when they may unexpectedly face a trespasser on the land and whether that trespasser is friendly or dangerous. My family and I cannot leave anything outside. We must hide our vehicle keys. We must look over our shoulders every minute while in our backyard or out in the pasture. My experience is unfortunately not unique. TSCRA conducted a border security survey of our members last year. The results show that the threats and challenges I face are the same ones faced by hundreds of my fellow ranchers across the state. As cattle raisers, we are doing our part to feed the world and raise the next generation of ranchers. We consistently deal with drought, inclement weather, increased input costs, and ever-fluctuating cattle prices. Those factors alone make ranching a costly endeavor and challenging livelihood. When you add in the cost resulting from the state of our border, it is almost impossible to make a profit. We cannot allow the situation to continue as it has. We must do better for our ranchers, our families, and all the citizens that are living through the crisis along the border.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Why does the debt automatically come up when we talk about farm bills?
He's the co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M, also the former chief economist of the House Ag Committee, Bart Fisher.
Bear with me, you know, through my wonky, nerdy pie chart here on budget, but it captures everything. This is the entire federal government in one. Okay, the maroon part you see at the top is split. You see half of it is defense. So that's discretionary. That's what the appropriators decide every year. They have their own caps, you know, for budget constraint. They have their own caps that are negotiated and that they have to live within. Half of that is defense. Almost all of our defense spending is decided every single year. The National Defense Authorization Act. Okay, so that's about a fourth of the government. You add the $8-odd trillion that we're going to pay in interest on all of our debt over the next 10 years, that gets you to about a third of the budget. That remaining two-thirds is mandatory spending. If you ever hear of entitlement spending, I mean, ARCA PLC is entitlement spending. If you have base acres and it triggers, you're entitled to a payment. It's where it comes from, right? So you look at that, though, that accounts for two-thirds, but literally half of the entire federal budget is in three programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And I bet for some of you who would have raised your hands about being concerned about the debt may also raise your hands of hands off. Don't touch them. Don't touch those things, right? So what you start looking at it and then, okay, well, what are we, for members who care about the debt, where are they focused? Well, you know what? Like, and most of these are all on autopilot. But like clockwork, every 5 years, this little sliver here, we bring it up every 5 years to reauthorize a farm bill. The rest of them, largely permanently authorized. So every 5 years, you get a farm bill. And part of my, you know, my hypothesis, having lived through it, is that you have members with this pent-up demand to try to get spending under control, and they see a vehicle with mandatory spending move every 5 years, and guess what? Some of the amendments, you would think if we just eliminated crop insurance, we could save the republic. I mean, you could eliminate it 1,000 times and barely make a dent. But I think it attracts that sort of thing because of this dynamic, right? Most of it is on autopilot. And there's not the will to have some of these very big, very tough conversations. And so what happens is every 5 years a farm bill comes up and suddenly we're talking about the budget and being able to get our fiscal house in order. And never mind, you can't do it on the backs of farmers alone. And quite frankly, I would argue, when you look at what we've whittled on that other table, we've whittled farm policy down to, we're doing a whole lot with very little on the farm policy front, to the point now where it's arguably insufficient. And so, to me, I don't think we're ever out of the woods on a debt conversation, in part because of this very dynamic. So when you look back then and you start to think about the farm safety net in particular, if you look back, in a lot of ways, where we are right now is very similar to where we were 20 years ago. So if you think back to Mr. Combest, right, the 96 Farm Bill, pendulum swung too far, right? We love the free market component of it. You can plant what you want. There's also no safety net left. What was the response? Double AMTA. You know, the 2002 Farm Bill rode that wave. Mr. Conaway prevailed on the budget committee for additional resources. He got it. That's the gray part. $60 billion in additional funding was added to Title I, and the whole point was, hey, we got to get away from all this stuff after the fact. I mean, growers are getting payments. They don't even know why they're, I mean, they can't tie it to anything. You know, and Mr. Combest argued this. We need to get away from that, get back to budgeted on-budget spending that we and a safety net we can count on, as opposed to one that's kind of after the appropriators decide after the fact to do something.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It is really exciting. We're bringing back high-tech manufacturing and something that is absolutely essential for our economy and has great strategic value.
Former Ohio Senator and U.S. Trade Representative Rob Portman on industrial policy.
So we're not going to bring back enough to say that America can be totally dependent on its own production. That's not going to happen, not in our lifetimes. But we are going to bring back enough, particularly at the high end. 90% of the high-end chips are made in Taiwan. 90%. And I mentioned the F-35, Taiwan. And think of the unfortunate but vulnerable position they're in right now. And I don't think it's wise for us to depend on that particular supply chain, given the obvious stresses that Taiwan is under with regard to China. So that's an example where I do think industrial policy, you can call it that. You can call it simply understanding the reality of the world, which is other countries aren't playing the same rules we are. So we're going to have to subsidize in order to be able to have a secure supply chain.
He says one of our chief concerns should be finding more workers.
Let's just be careful not to overregulate, because, you know, we kill the goose that lays the golden egg. Cecilia is an economist, and she did a great job. On the one hand, on the other hand.
Exactly.
Like, there's this story, probably apocryphal, of Harry Truman said, bring me a one-armed economist, because the economist kept coming into the Oval Office and saying, on the one hand, on the other hand. But I guess what I would focus on is people who are still on the sidelines, because 3.5% is not an accurate number. Now, I say that because you have to be looking for work. And a lot of people aren't looking for work, and you may know some of them. And the opioid epidemic in this country has added to this. So 100,000 people are dying every year from opioids. But think of the millions of people who are unfortunately addicted and not looking for work. So how do you get these people off the sidelines and into the job market? That's, I think, the next great challenge. And there are ways to do it. And in response to gentleman's question, that we talked about training a little bit. We didn't just scratch the surface, but Cecilia just talked about lifelong learning. I mean, there are jobs out there that are wanting, and there are employers that are looking for people right now. They can't find the skills. And to skill these people up is possible. We had a presentation today, without getting into great detail, it was about some successes that the Business Roundtable has mentioned, but other companies around the country are using to take people who have given up, you know, who really are don't have a positive view of what their future might be, and giving them these basic skills. And then, sure enough, they get into the workforce. Once they get into the workforce, then their employer might pay to send them just to college, might pay to send them to get reskilled. And so I think that's still where we as a country are not doing everything we can to engage everybody. And I look at the issue of people who have left the prison system. So these are folks who, you know, made a mistake, and sometimes it's called second chance, sometimes it's third chance, fourth chance, fifth chance. But there's a great potential there. We have a growing group of people who are, you know, formerly incarcerated, who are, many of them, unfortunately, have mental health or drug addiction issues. It's worth it addressing that for all the right reasons, for their potential in life, their God-given potential to be achieved, but also for our economy. We need those workers. And then finally would be immigration. You know, we do have to figure that out. And it's not just about the visas for these students who are coming or who are going to Canada now, come instead of the United States, which is true. It's also, you know, stapling that green card to their diploma when they get this STEM diploma, because we want them here. But we need workers at every level. And to have a legal immigration system that's regulated, not an illegal system that we have right now, but a legal one, makes a lot of sense for our economy and our future.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Weed control is always a topic of interest, but we found that 73% of the farmers did feel that the weed control was better after the cover crops, and only 2% thought it was worse.
Dr. Rob Myers with the University of Missouri with results from the National Cover Crop Survey.
And then there was a fair chunk at a quarter that thought it was about the same. Of course, that could depend on the species of cover crops they're using, timing of termination, and so on. So we wanted to move on into the cover crop species and mixes, because that's a perennial question we get with cover crops. What are farmers using? And I should mention, I work with the SARE program based at University of Missouri, and we've put out information on a lot of different cover crops over the years. We know there's over 40 different species of cover crops being sold today in the U.S., and this is reflected in what we see farmers using, lots of different cover crops. But clearly the one that stands out, no surprise probably to anyone, is cereal rye, sometimes called the queen of cover crops, used almost three times as much as any other individual species. We see radish there in second place, but closely followed by winter wheat, crimson clover, and lots of other options. So clearly farmers have a wide range of species they're interested in. But in many cases, they're not planting these as the sole cover crop in the field. They're doing them as part of mixes. So we had several questions asking about mixes. First of all, were they using mixes? And we found that about two-thirds were planting mixes in 2022. An additional a couple percent had done them, but maybe we're going to not do it in 23. And then some had not done them at all. Lots of different approaches in terms of number of mixes. Some were doing just two species together, some three, and obviously there were quite a few farmers doing four or more species in a mix. And a general pattern we've seen over the years with the survey is that the longer farmers use cover crops, the more they shift the mixes and the more complex their mixes tend to get. And that's not true of every farmer, but it's a general trend that we see. When we look at the species used in the mix, it's a pretty similar pattern in terms of what's most popular to earlier. There's just not the predominance of the cereal rye, even though it is used about half of the time in mixes. But we see radishes being very common in mixes at just under a half the time. And then a number of other things being popular, oats, crimson clover being the most popular legume, but we see that more in the southern corn belt than the northern area where it's not as adapted. But many different species obviously being used in mixes. In terms of how things have changed over time, like I was just alluding to, we see the green fraction, 45%, the number of their species has increased. So not quite half the farmers, about a similar number. They've kept that number of species the same. And then there's a small percentage that's decreased, that maybe they started out with mixes and just weren't satisfied with that, found it a little messy, so they went back to maybe just doing a single species. Yield impact is something that's always of great interest with cover crops. We probably have a whole webinar just on this topic. There's been a wide range of reports on cover crops. I really value myself what farmers share with their experience, because they are really focused on optimizing their yields. Sometimes in short-term trials, maybe the focus is on something else like a water quality study, or there's just not time to really get the system figured out if somebody's just doing a yield study for a couple of years. But in this case, looking at farmers with a range of experiences, our whole population of farmers, you see a pattern where it's gradually increasing over time, but lots of diversity, some that are getting significant yield benefits, some that are getting losses. But again, that trend towards an improvement over time.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
By the way, when we wrote the 18 Farm Bill, the amount of, that we wrote Title I with was the same amount that was added to the 02 Farm Bill. That's how far it has been squeezed over time.
Dr. Bart Fisher is former chief economist at the House Ag Committee, now co-director, Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M.
So the question mark, I mean, think of it. You go to this next list, all these things, WIP, ERP, MFP, CFAP, PAP, all of this ad hoc stuff that has come, I would argue has come, you know, because the pendulum, again, swung too far the other way, right? We squeezed Title I too far, and Congress proves it. You know, on one hand, in a farm bill, it's hard to get anything done. But then Congress proves, well, we don't want to leave you guys hanging, so we're going to do all this other stuff. I think one of our challenges right now is that somehow all this stuff starts to look a little easier than a farm bill. You think of all those amendments in a farm bill, well, where were the amendments that came with all these things? They were added to end-of-year spending packages, or they were done by the administration. MFP was done by the Trump administration, you know, without Congress having to weigh in at all. Cotton ginning cost share, it started with Mr. Vilsack in the Obama administration. You know, so you start looking at it. I mean, I still have a question mark over what's going to happen, because the ag groups are going to have to get vocal, demanding, you know, from their representatives in D.C. that no, you know, yes, we're grateful for the ad hoc, but it's not bankable, reliable. And at some point, you know, it's going to catch up with us. We want it added to standing farm policy. And so that's the debate that's going to be had. We'll see how it goes.
But writing a farm bill really needs to have a purpose of improving.
You know, what's the point of doing it if we don't see improvements? Let's say we do get new funding, then where do we go with that 222 vote margin? I think one of them is there's still a question of, could we just do it bipartisan? I mean, it's where it's going to end up. The Senate didn't change. It's very similar to the last two farm bills. The one that ultimately went across to the president's desk was a bipartisan bill. So can we just start there, forget about, you know, SNAP being at $1 trillion, and just move on through? You know, potentially, I still have my doubts, again, because I think we're going to have a budget conversation. And who knows what all was agreed to as part of the speaker vote. You know, I don't know how that's going to play out. Otherwise, I do see it coming, particularly with some of the new budget rules, that you could see a situation on the House side where they pair SNAP cuts with improvements to the farm safety net. And I think on all of this, you know, there's a lot of hand-wringing that goes on. My encouragement to you is to just, you know, don't worry about all the day-to-day interaction of this. This is what the leaders, those four I put up on the screen, this is the part that they're trying to figure out. And if you look from a distance and think that everyone's lost their mind in D.C., I mean, to a degree, you may be right. But they're trying to find that pathway to 218, as messy as it may be.
already some different ideas floating around.
What about margin, incorporating cost of production? You know, we hear a lot about, well, is it going to go in Title I? Could that replace ARCID PLC? I don't think that's going to happen. In part because if you already have a crop insurance product, Congress is sort of loath to do something administered by FSA if there's already a product out there where you could put skin in the game. I'm not going to ask, if any of you raised your hand and said you've purchased margin coverage, it's because you've got farms in other areas of the country. It's not available here, right? It's a limited offering on specific crops. It really started with rice. Corn came in, but it's very limited. It's a county-based margin. It has not been terribly popular. So one big question mark you could follow is, could there be some significant improvements to the RMA-administered margin protection policy? I think that that's also a possibility, but I don't see that porting over into Title I. I think the path, not necessarily the path of least resistance, the smart path there is simply, you know, make your reference prices more reflective of cost of production. You get to the same end without having to completely recreate the mousetrap.
To Agriculture Today.
This is
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Administration believes, and I believe this myself, I think, you know, we had a very lively discussion about this question.
Cecilia Rouse is the former chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors.
Does free, you know, we have followed a very, not very, but we've had an open free trade economic policy. I'm an economist, I'm a PhD economist, please don't make me give back my PhD over what I'm about to say, is my profession has very much emphasized the benefits of economic efficiency. And so many of us would completely agree that, you know, open trade and a lot of technological advances, all that is very good. It increases the size of the pie. But what it is a little much lighter on is equity. And some of us are very concerned that, and it's been documented from, like, economist at MIT, David Otter, that, for example, the accession of China to the WTO and trade with China has had, we've all benefited in the lower prices, and we have so many of these. I'm not sure whether actually the last one is so valuable in my household, but we've benefited in terms of lower prices, but the costs have been not borne as equally, and there are parts of our country and there are parts of our population that have severely borne the cost. I have colleagues, Anne Case and Angus Deaton, who documented the deaths of despair. They have tied that to some of this unequal costs of this trade. And so through this industrial policy, if we can right some of that as well by trying to be strategic in where some of these investments are made, if we can bring jobs back or revitalize some communities or help those who've been left behind benefit more from this economic activity, that may help us have a healthier economy in the sense of there may be some cost in terms of pure economic efficiency, but if we have some gains in terms of equity, maybe that'll help with, I don't know, the polarization that we're having in this country, and helping for having a more sustainable economy going forward. These are questions. I put myself in the category of industrial policy can go very wrong. I'm not going to argue that the public sector and all the, you know, government officials have all of the right information or going to get exactly right. But what I would argue is it's not obvious to me that doing everything decentralized and having government completely out of it has gotten it right either. And let's be very vigilant in how we try, which is what the president is doing. He's got these, you know, people who are really trying to ensure that implementation is going well. But let's try to learn from it so that we can learn the best of when is it appropriate for the government to do a little bit more direction through subsidies, through tax credits, or however it might be trying to nudge things in which direction. When does that go well? When does it not go well? When does the government need to get out of the way? But I think it's a moment to actually learn something so that we can have a society that is actually healthier going forward.
But she also warns that hard times and decisions are coming.
I do believe maybe necessity is the mother of invention. I think that was part of the discussion that it will get addressed when it must be addressed. But that feels very inefficient from my point of view. If we were to address it earlier, we could do it at lower costs and by not having as big of an impact on any particular groups of people. So it would be wonderful for us to take this as, the Fitch downgrade is just another reminder that we do need to get our fiscal house in order. It does require making hard choices, which requires compromise on both sides and really working together.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Food prices at the grocery store are still rising. They were up 0.4% last month, which is worrisome, but
they're still lower than what we were seeing at this time last year,
when prices were really skyrocketing. This from Ag Department economist Megan Schweitzer. She says that according to the latest Consumer Price Index, supermarket food prices are running 3.6% higher than 1 year ago. But Megan says, think back to this time last year.
The peak for food price growth was in August of 2022. Just about a year ago, all food peaked at 11.4% higher than the prior year. And food at home was even higher, peaking at 13.5%. And so that's come down quite a bit, almost 10%.
Just about into a so-called normal range of food inflation. Megan says July's price hike might have been lower, but for some higher prices for foods like beef, pork, and fresh and processed vegetables. Gary Crawford, Washington.